South Korea and the U.S. announced their first confirmed coronavirus cases at virtually the same time in late January. If you take a look at where we are right now in the U.S. now has 50 times more cases and almost 100 times more fatalities than South Korea. Meanwhile, while the U.S. makes up only about 4.25% of the world's population, the U.S. has 30% of the world's reported coronavirus cases and almost 20% of the reported coronavirus deaths. Sanjay Gupta said this is all because we got started too late in the U.S. Is that right? Do you agree?
You know, it isn't as simple as that, Jake. I'm sorry. I mean, to just say this is all happening because we got started too late. Obviously, if you look, could you have done something a little bit earlier? Would have had an impact, obviously. But where we are right now is the result of a number of factors.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci with CNN's Jake Tapper on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday in an exchange that was widely reported, I would even say misreported, as Fauci says President Trump's failure to act sooner obviously cost lives. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined remotely in this, the beginning of our second month of quarantine broadcasting, by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, gang.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Can you even imagine what a happy Monday would look like? Does anyone think we'll ever have a happy Monday again?
Yes, I'm happy right now because I'm talking to my colleagues. Nick, are you alive?
Yes.
Sound a little bit qualified, a little qualified immunity.
It did before coronavirus, man.
we started that with that clip for a reason, which is that we're going to have an extended conversation in the second half of this episode about the highs and lows of media coverage and also of government dissemination of information about the evil COVID-19. But as usual, let's start with the grisly bullet points. Estimated deaths in the U.S. from the virus are now north of 22,000. That's up from around 10,000 last time the four of us convened. Overall number of cases is getting close to 600,000, which is up from 337,000 a week ago. Coronavirus is now the number one killer in the country, leading to totals of excess deaths in New York in particular that are just amazing to comprehend, much greater than in September 2001, for example. At the same time, the curve of new cases and strains on hospital capacity in New York in particular continues to flatten, and most projection models are foreseeing the apex could happen in this country in a matter of days, with a final body count closer to 60,000 than some of the more horrendous numbers that we were seeing before. And much of the political and policy conversation shifted to when and how are we going to reopen, which is a cheerier thing than ventilator shortages. And a lot of the conversation, in fact, with Fauci and Jake Tapper was precisely on that. It's where people are transitioning to. But in the meantime, as we transition from kind of lockdown to whatever it is and whenever it is that comes next, there have been a lot of tales of over-aggressive enforcement of distancing orders and designations of non-essentialness and so on. So we're going to start with kind of a roundup of a few of those that are making news or should be making news. Catherine, you're a religiously observant type. Tell us a bit how cops in Mississippi observed the Holy Week.
So I do want to say, though I am not a religiously observant type, I did do two seders and celebrate Easter this week because there's nothing else
type
to do. So I guess I am now. In Greenville, Mississippi, churchgoers who attended a drive-in service were fined $500 per person for violating a curfew order. This is the kind of thing I think we're going to see come up in subsequent weeks and months as good test cases for the limits of these curfews, and also test cases on the kind of common sense limits of how social distancing orders and lockdowns and curfews are interpreted. Because in this case, we had devout churchgoers of the King James Bible Baptist Church who sat in their cars with the windows rolled up, circled around a church, and tuned their radios to the station where their pastor was delivering the Easter service. This was not unsafe. It just wasn't. And so the fact that police showed up to not this, just this church, but a couple of other churches in the area, issued $500 tickets per person. Again, there's a man quoted in a local news article saying that both he and his wife got separate tickets. Presumably, the police had to interact with the individuals to issue these tickets, thereby initiating exposure that had previously not been a risk. We saw something similar. Reason did a story last week about a woman in Pennsylvania who was driving alone in her car and got pulled over and hit with a fine for social distancing. Her fine was eventually dropped. I actually so far have been impressed that when an individual officer in an individual city oversteps, they've been backing down. And I hope that that continues, that there is kind of a reign of common sense and peace. But I think the longer this goes on, the harder it will be to let that wiggle room exist. And the more tempted people will be by black and white rules that are rules for the sake of rules rather than rules for the sake of health.
Nick, the governor of Michigan, that lady, has come in for all kinds of criticism. You're writing about that. What the hell's going on there?
She's also come in for praise. The New York Times and other outlets have recently talked about, you know, how she's a stalwart defender of, you know, public health and whatnot. But in Michigan, they've issued a bunch of increasingly restrictive shelter in place oriented rules. And of most kind of outrage inducing lately have been, you know, that you can't buy seeds for gardens and things like that, vegetable seeds at stores, at gardening centers and things like that. And that Home Depot can be open for certain things, but you can't buy things like paint. And, you know, this is the type of stuff where I think a lot of, kind of picking up on what Catherine's talking about, this is where these orders are going to go to, if not die, cause a lot of conflict, because people are, you know, the longer they're at home and the longer they have less things to do, you know, they're going to want to do more things. Michigan, the most recent order also bans landscaping services from working, which seems particularly bizarre since, you know, I don't know if you guys have ever had your lawns cut or something like that, but it's like, you know, first off, a lot of the times there's only one or two people on a crew and they're going to be doing it, you know, distant from people. So, you know, this is where we are now. You know, and I think we're going to see increasing friction over what are we allowed to do and what are we not allowed to do? What are we allowed to buy? I mean, Vermont also was closing off aisles in Walmarts that were deemed non-essential. Big problem.
My two brothers, if they had lived in Michigan, might have already committed homicides, because one of them has been planting a victory garden and tending to it. And the other one has been feverishly building, you know, doll houses and bunk beds and things.
Can I
of
ask
that
though, who will be the greater, like, what's the greater failure rate, sourdough bread bakers or victory gardeners? Like, who's gonna more regret their investment in that thing?
It's a good question, because like sourdough, it's not, the investment is time, and then just looking back and saying, what the hell did I do, instead
the,
of
the investment
just
is like caring. That's the, like.
So I made sourdough bread this weekend using.
Of course you did.
Using the starter.
Have some kids.
Using the starter that my wife had made before she left town to go care for her sick father. It's like a 3-day process in which you have to feed it on Friday, and then you have to come in on Saturday, and once every hour for like 3 or 4 hours, you've got to flour it and fold it and sort of like talk to it and say like read it a poem or something. And then you put it in the fridge overnight, and then you take it out again, and you have to take it out and you have to read it another poem and flour it and fold it one more time, cover it with like a special piece of cloth or something, and then like eventually, like an hour before it's ready, you have to start talking to the oven and get the oven heated up, and then and only then, after like 72 hours of kind of just, you know, occasional management, right? It's like playing Animal Crossing. It's one of these video games that exists in real time and just sort of expects you to do things on a schedule. for whatever.
Why, at the end why of would it, anyone do any of those things voluntarily?
At the end of it, you get the most amazing, delicious bread, and it is so good, and it means that I've got...
You could just still buy bread.
So grocery delivery is very difficult. We're not going to grocery stores. And this is just much, much better than any bread that I've ever been able to get delivered.
I just want the listeners to understand that when we first met young Suderman, before he successfully coupled, the dude's entire food palette was like Stouffer's pizzas in the microwave. That's not even joking.
In the toaster oven, in his defense.
Them in a toaster oven. I never microwaved any pizza.
I do think.
That's what Hot Pockets were for, Matt.
I do think that it's much, much darker to make your Stouffer's pizza in a microwave than it is in a toaster oven. That's an important distinction about the level of depravity that he was working with. So I don't slander the man.
We are talking about pointless restrictions, not self-imposed, Suderman, but usually, though probably not always, a government-imposed. Can't you tell us one that has to do with booze?
Yeah, so Pennsylvania closed down its state-run liquor stores in the middle of March. Pennsylvania runs all of the liquor stores in the state. It is a control state with possibly... arguably the most onerous liquor rules in the country to begin with. It's not the only control state in the country, but it is probably the one that is the most restrictive in terms of buying booze, even when we are not in the middle of a pandemic. But what happened was they closed down all of their liquor stores, and that meant that the only way that you could legally buy spirits inside the state was to buy from one of the state's craft producers. So if they have a craft distillery that has a license to sell direct to consumers in the state, you could buy from them. That was legal. But you couldn't buy a national brand of any kind. If you wanted Jack Daniels, if you wanted Buffalo Trace, if you wanted something like that, there was no way to legally buy it within the state. And so what did people do? They went to New Jersey and to West Virginia, and they went to the stores that were nearby in New Jersey and West Virginia, and they went to them in such large numbers that there was a huge crush of customers, and at least one store in New Jersey had to close down because people were too close to each other. Now, the reason that they closed the liquor stores in the first place, according to the governor, was because they wanted to help enforce social distancing, reduce travel, right? Keep people away from each other. And instead, what they did was they sent people to an even smaller, more packed place. So they didn't just make it difficult to buy liquor. They made it dangerous. It actually got to the point where one county in West Virginia started saying that when we card you, and we're going to card you, if you present a Pennsylvania ID, we will not sell you liquor at all because we don't want people from Pennsylvania coming over and crowding our stores. And so this was an incredibly dumb decision on their part. Now, they tried to make up for it at the end of March, or maybe it was the very beginning of April, by opening an online sales portal that had a limited stock, and then also you were limited to one order per day and a certain number of bottles. I forget exactly what the limitations there were, but it was there's a smaller amount of stuff, only one order per day, and you can't just buy as much as you want, but we will ship it to your house if you order online. Except the problem was the online sales portal didn't work. Didn't work at all. And it just...
What? That's so weird. A government website that was spun up quickly didn't work well? That's so surprising.
So then they started... And
what's
just
up, Chuck Stossel?
Yeah. It's very, very surprising. And so they had a notice up that said, due to overwhelming demand, we're experiencing problems. We're going to put a plan into place to fix this. And their plan was that they would open it randomly throughout the day without letting anyone know, so that you would just have to check it all the time. But what does that do to a server load? This was actually a point made by our great tech guy, Justin Marr, who we owe so much to at Reason. That puts a huge extra load on the server and makes it even more difficult to buy stuff that you want to buy. It's really ridiculous. It is bad as business. It is bad for people who want to buy booze when they are locked in their houses. It is bad for public health. It's a stupid, stupid plan on nearly every level.
So I am no epidemiologist, but from what I understand.
Oh, come on, yeah, Matt. Don't sell yourself short. I know.
Do we have to add that to our, I didn't vote for Donald Trump, but.
We're all epidemiologists these days. I think we all just got honorary degrees.
I had just finished my, Khan Academy course on structural engineering and had finally figured out 9/11. Yeah. So I'm ready for a new, education challenge.
Jet fuel melt steel, Nick?
You know what? It's good, though. I use it for sourdough bread and in a couple of, drinks,
He said,
He's
a jet fuel genius who can solve the world's problems without even trying.
One of the great tiki drinks is, in fact,
genius.
One of the great classic tiki drinks that everybody should try making is, in fact, a Jet Pilot. Three different types of rum, Falernum.
Every tiki drink has three different kinds of rum in it.
Not all. Some of them only have two.
Yeah, two and then vodka or something. But
I can only hope, having you mentioned the word tiki, that the world's greatest bar, which is the Tiki Tea on Sunset Boulevard in Silver Lake, California, which is smaller than the tiny room that I'm podcasting from right now, has been allowed to do to-go drinks during these difficult times, because there's no way physically they cannot violate all the social distancing rules there.
The drinks there were always to-go drinks?
Takes you to another place in another land. From what I understand about the transmission of viruses and the way that it's best to get healthy is that, generally speaking, sunshine and fresh air is helpful in getting better with your viruses. And so,
do you have a point, Matt?
My category of ridiculous government crackdowns is all throughout Southern California. There are cops on beaches arresting paddleboarders in Malibu. There's an entire Manhattan Beach, otherwise known as Manhattan Beach, obviously. They've got cops parked on the pier issuing citation after citation. It's like fat cops jogging after joggers who are running right along the ocean, on these completely empty beaches. It's absolutely ridiculous. If you treat people, especially people in places where it's nice to go outside, if you treat them like hamsters in those little tubes, they're going to start spritzing out. There's broader policy questions.
Wait, they're going to start spritzing out?
Yeah.
Sort of I was just going to let that go.
Spritz?
Yeah. Okay. What the fuck?
Listen.
Okay.
English language, Nick, is a very malleable.
No, it is true. It's devolving as we speak.
There's broader stuff that Suderman pointed out in the Slack channel, so maybe he can sort of tee up, because I don't obviously understand any of it. But in addition to worldwide governments taking various, or one of the ways in which governments worldwide are taking kind of intrusive power accumulating measures in the face of this, one of them is using your cell phone, technological surveillance, Google and Apple and whatnot. Peter, can you walk us or hint us in a direction what that means, why it's bad or good?
Yeah. So you mentioned up front that one of the things we're going to be talking about today are plans to reopen. And right now there is no single unified clear plan that's coming out of the White House, but there are a bunch of plans that have been put forth as proposals, as potential ideas from a variety of think tanks, economists, etc., from all parts of the political spectrum. And if you look at them, what they basically all say is that in order to start the reopening process in earnest, not just relaxing a few of the more modest restrictions, we're going to need pretty significant either technological surveillance tools or mass testing on a scale that it's really not clear we're ever going to be able to get to, at least until we have a vaccine. And the surveillance proposals, and particularly the one coming out of the Center for American Progress, are pretty scary in a lot of ways, because they basically suggest that somehow or another, we would need to use phones to track pretty much every single person's movement constantly, and all of their connections and all of the ways in which they get near to any other person. And that would need to be done in a way that is completely unprecedented, that it's not clear how you would enforce it, any enforcement mechanism you could come up with. It's not clear whether it would be constitutional. So one proposal is that you would combine that with a a mass testing regime, and you would say that people couldn't get tested unless they had the app installed on their phone that would upload their location information should they end up testing positive for COVID-19. You know, there are other sort of methods that people have suggested for requiring people to do this or strongly encouraging them. And it's really kind of worrying, in a way that this could end up really empowering government to do some pretty unique, pretty unprecedented tracking of movement and of connection. And the idea is that you would be free to move about, but not free to move about anonymously, not free to move about without people knowing where you were, because the idea is, and this is, you know, there is, in fact, some public health, some reasons, you know, in terms of public health to think that this is true. Movement is the threat right now. Proximity is the threat. And so that's what needs that. The idea is that is what needs to be controlled. And the idea is that that is what governments are going to have to step in and manage. Now, I think there are some less worrisome alternatives, in particular, Apple and Google have released some technical specifications that might allow for less onerous, more private, more kind of opt-in systems in which people simply decide they want to be part of this because it will be helpful to them and it might be helpful to others. And so I don't think it is necessarily that we are necessarily heading for a world in which the government controls all movement or at least monitors all movement. But that's something that people are kind of talking about right now. And they're talking about it in a way that's serious, where they think that over the next several months or a year, maybe that's what we need to spin up. And I think even the people who are talking about the strongest forms of this, they will say, look, we want to try to maintain privacy. We want to try to do this in a way that's constitutional. We want to try and do this in a way that there's, you know, that it's all at least quasi-anonymous, except for people who are, who end up testing positive. But this is a very bizarre world that we are potentially stepping into, that we are talking about building here. And I think that we're at least going to see, we are already seeing tech companies and governments start trying to work together to try and figure out how to do some of this. And in fact, in other countries, they're already pushing much further than has happened in the United States. There are already apps where you can see who's got it in your neighborhood, where you can see how many people have it in proximity to you, where all of this stuff is public. And that's coming. That's coming to the Western world. That is coming people are going to try to bring it to the United States. And it is something that I think anybody who is concerned about privacy should be very worried about.
We are, I think right now, 100% of the country is under some kind of emergency order by their states. So various levels of quarantine, stay at home orders and whatnot. And I don't know, but I'm sure some percentage are in papers, please. Mode. I mean, Rhode Island, near where Nick and I live here in New York, was trying to ticket or at least stop, flag down passengers with New York plates to say, you know, get the hell out of our pristine state of Rhode Island. And I know a guy who's a listener to this podcast who has to show his papers in order to travel back and forth between Oregon and California. It's terrifying. All right. Unless anyone has more dystopian things to say about that, we can go straight into our media coverage highs and lows during this time. Let's start with a low. It's more fun. And let's start first with the president over the weekend tweeting, "I am working hard to expose the corruption and dishonesty in the lamestream media. That part is easy. The hard part is why. The New York Times story is a fake." This is one of these long TikToks of why it didn't work out, the federal response. It's actually not that great of a written story. I had to abandon it halfway through, but whatever. The New York Times story is a fake, just like the paper itself. Blah, 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 blah. This is a perennial every single day when the president comes out and gets badgered by the Jim Acostas of the world. It's just sort of this low level tension here. So I wanted to get into what we think that media has done well and poorly. Nick, why don't you start, since you love the media more than you love life itself? What do you think the media has done particularly not so bueno over this past month?
You know, I'll start with this, and I guess I wrote about this last week, but, you know, Trump's daily briefings are pretty amazing, and I don't recommend anybody watch all of them all the time, but they're worth dipping into, because between him and his team, it is a completely naked and unvarnished interface with the media and with the press. And what comes through, less than Trump being kind of trollish and childish and whatnot, and, you know, and he's got his team, Fauci is there, Mike Pence, Deborah Birx, or Dr. Birx, you know, who are all to varying degrees responsive and interesting. It's the level of questions from the press are so moronic. I mean, where they're actually asking questions about whether or not Trump is going to pardon Joe Exotic from Tiger King.
Wait, is he?
As opposed
is he
to
do that?
Anything.
Stop it.
You know, he's going to look into it. He thought that, you know, Donald Jr. is you know, building the case for it. But it's, what the hell is wrong with people? Like, they complained all of the time that Trump didn't have traditional press conferences, et cetera. And then they've got him and they're asking questions like that. And most of the other questions are like, why didn't you do something earlier? Why didn't you do this? Like, it's revealing. And it's, you know, what it's revealing is that the media in many cases, and at least the people who get into the quarantine press office, you know, press room above the old swimming pool in the White House, they're just not asking questions that anybody really cares about. So I would say that's a low point, but it's also, it is something to watch and to dip into, you know, every day between whatever it is, like 4:30 and 5:30, you know, and then you also have even more bizarrely, various people, including, you know, supposedly good media groups, you know, suing or trying to get the FCC to ban these or to have networks not take them, to, you know, lobby MSNBC to cut away and show, you know, whatever, you know, I mean, it's they this. We were an insane country before the lockdown, and we're getting close to, you know, we're morphing into, you know, a kind of wide version of the Saw franchise, where, you know, we're all chained to the radiator. And it's just a question of what, you know, what limbs are we going to be chewing off to get out of this room?
The clip that we played at the top, the broader interview, which I recommend people listen to, one of the reasons why I think Fauci is given more of a rock star status than most people in this is actually that he's pretty good at saying what he doesn't know and equivocating beyond, you know, he's being baited constantly by the media to try to get into a fight with Donald Trump, which is not hard because Donald Trump's crazy and says crazy things all the time, or contradictory things, or things that Dr. Fauci himself doesn't believe, whatever. And he's really good about sort of basically saying, look, I give advice, doing what I can. President does what he can. Some things are political. Some things are medical. Sometimes, you know, the medical people don't have all the answers themselves, that those things have to be decided by governors and other things. And like, everyone will look for the five words in that exchange that will then cause the fight between Fauci and Trump, because they want to have a good guy and they want to have a bad guy. And it's very frustrating. Catherine, what is a low bit of a media behavior reportage that you have witnessed so far over this past month plus?
So I think we did a pretty decent job just now. And by we, I mean Peter, in explaining some of the technical aspects of what might be coming in terms of tracking. But I have been astonished at how bad in general the coverage has been of what might be coming next. And I think, you know, that's understandable for lots of reasons. We don't really know what might be coming next. We don't know what the future holds. Everything feels sort of unpredictable, even more so than usual. But just, you know, I happened to watch just a clip of like random afternoon CNN over the weekend. And they were describing this contact tracing thing, and they repeatedly referred to it as relying on GPS, as being likely to rely on GPS, as being location tracking. And while there are variants of it that use that, the version that is most, that is being talked about by Apple and Google, and this was specifically about the Apple and Google tool, relies on Bluetooth. And that's dumb, like it's a small thing, but it means something different. It means it's a very different technology. It means that the privacy implications are very different. And I am always and forever struck by how bad the media in general are at explaining technical details, particularly if explaining those details in a nuanced way would mean they can't say big tech is bad. But the resurgence of the big tech is bad narrative after a brief break has been kind of disappointing to me since, of course, it seems clear that big tech is one of the only things functioning in our society. And we talked about this a little bit last week, I think, with the Zoom investigation, the fact that Congress is like, we need to really look into this Zoom thing. It seems like it's dangerous. It's like, dudes. Of all the things that are dangerous, like Zoom bombing is not your priority. Please fucking stop. And so, yeah, just in general, I would say tech coverage is typically bad. It's been even more bad than usual because it has a lot more uncertainty in it now. And when you talk about that pool of people in those White House briefings, like I've always thought it might be a good practice to rotate in journalists who are on other beats, who are not just political journalists, people who are
covering who do tech policy, like Tiger King,
people who cover healthcare policy, fine, do a day where you rotate in the entertainment reporters and have them ask about Tiger King, but like let's not pretend we're doing one thing when we're doing the other. So I wish everyone could do a little better on tech journalism, and I commend to you Andrea O'Sullivan and other Reason writers who are technologically literate and trying their best to actually explain things.
Just add that the Zoom panic about its privacy and so on has led the New York City Department of Education to phase away and stop doing their Zoom meetings and replace it with something else. And it's kind of unclear what, and it's going to be onerous. But the best side effect of all of that is that finally, for a week or so, we're not having Zoom all the time in my house.
Don't worry.
Why does it bother you, Matt?
Pretty soon, you're going
to
have...
Do you have to be on it? Or
what does what bother me?
The Zoom stuff. It's your kids doing it, right?
Have you met a five-year-old recently, Nick?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're not that good at video chatting.
And imagine a five-year-old who has my genes as well. So it's
Did your children inherit your like tech poison?
No
trait.
No, and in fact, they both do workarounds of problems that I create. They can teach me. Suderman, stop chuckling at me. Start telling me about a way in which the journalisming industry has not covered itself in glory over the past month.
I'm just going to take some real low-hanging fruit here. And I think my favorite, I almost appreciated it so bad. My favorite journalism fail of the past month or so was when One America News, which is this it's like Fox's id unleashed or something. It's like take the most crazily pro-Trump sort of parts of Fox News and then expose them to like an even more pro-Trump virus and let it become like exponentially grow for a lot, or like it took like a little chunk of Fox News and turned it into sourdough starter and then created a network out of only that. And they reported that maybe the virus actually came from North Carolina, and they cited a citizen investigator who turns out to be a QAnon conspiracy theorist. And then when they were showing the photo of the citizen investigator, they didn't show a photo. They said they were showing a photo of him, but they weren't showing a photo of him. They were showing a photo of his Twitter avatar, which is Dave Bowman, 2001 A Space Odyssey. And so Dave Bowman from 2001 A Space Odyssey figured out that actually the virus was produced in North Carolina. And that's what's really going on here. And guys, like I said, it's completely terrible. On the other hand, it's almost worth having a network around like that just for the ridiculousness, for the enjoyable awfulness of it.
Both my low point and my high point will be in the same anecdote, so we'll use that as the hinge moment.
You're like the guy when you do the drinking game where everyone drinks really fast and then there's the anchor in the end who has to drink the two cups before it goes back down. That's you.
Very much so. In fact, we should... My new idea for the Reason Roundtable, maybe a fourth, let's, in order to deal with the hole left in our hearts by the Soho Forum having to social distance, we should do a Reason Century Club.
Yes. No. Where we just,
this is a great idea.
No.
Like, this is the ideas guy, like Bill Blazejowski. Give me the tape recorder.
You are the ideas guy.
Thank you. No. So there's a great piece, which is the one thing I will commend, about a not so great dude. And the great piece is in The Bulwark, that Never Trump outlet, started by Bill Kristol and some other people. And it was a guy, Jim Miller, I think, wrote the story. Does I have his name right? Anyways, it was about a podcaster, kind of sports bro.
It's by Tim
guy
Miller,
who's
former Jeb Bush communications guy and kind of GOP consultant type.
Who has done some pretty good writing over there. I don't know his whole career, but he's pretty good at stuff. But anyways, he wrote this profile of Clay Travis, who is kind of an avatar of a category that has particularly irritated me, which probably says more about me than anything else, which is super confident contrarian, coronavirus contrarian bro, who has leaned into it. And this is the gift of the piece, has leaned into it as a great marketing opportunity. And his podcast has absolutely taken off ever since about 5 weeks ago or 6 weeks ago. He did a whole bit about how, you know, we are right now, the infection rates and death rates do not appear to be inordinately higher than the flu. If you are dumb enough to not understand what exactly is going on here, then frankly, that's an indictment of your own intelligence. You don't deserve to be able to analyze anything or comment on anything. It's unlikely, in my opinion, that more than a few hundred at most will die from the coronavirus in the United States, and so on. And he took that as a hinge moment, not to like say, oh, I got out over my skis here and maybe I made a prediction that didn't turn out to be true, but to become a center of coronavirus skepticism, which is not to say that there isn't a whole lot of skepticism to be had about the way things are covered and about the claims that are made and about people who prematurely think that they are endorsing science when there's a lot of fluidity out there. But he is this type, just incredibly irritating. But also, he has found a market niche, and there has just been this mushroom cloud of people cherry picking stats, filling up my inbox with forwarded emails that make me want to throw my computer through a window. He's the avatar of it. But the Bulwark piece, called The Ballad of Clay Travis, is an example of pretty interesting journalism done right now during the midst of all this. So let's go to positiveness. What has been positive, Nick, besides radical acts of transparency from Donald Trump, from your point of view, that the media has been involved with over the past?
I've really been enjoying the Twitter feed of Nate Silver of 538.com. He seems to me to be striking... And also the articles at 538, it seems to me to be striking the right balance between thoughtful kind of cogitation on things that are coming out, particularly as they relate to statistical models and whatnot, and kind of poking at places where things don't seem to be adding up. There's a really fascinating kind of divergence, Matt, that you were getting at between the predicted models of, you know, what, how many hospital beds we were going to need in New York, right? How many ICU beds were going to be used, how many deaths were going to be. And there's a massive divergence. A couple of days ago, the New York Times reported, you know, that the models had a need for 140,000 hospital beds in New York City. It turned out that there were like 18,500 beds being used. And, you know, this, there's, you know, nobody really knows what's going on. It's clear the models are not accurate. In talking to Matt Ridley and Ron Bailey, two science journalists of, you know, real stature, they've been saying for a long time now that as data becomes available, you have to feed specific data into models to correct the models. That really hasn't been happening. And I think somebody like Nate Silver has been doing really interesting work to, you know, and again, and he doesn't seem to have an axe to grind or anything, but to kind of try and figure out how do we get a closer approximation to what is actually going on as opposed to what we think was going to be going on. And that's important because that leads to, you know, when do we start to reopen things? How do we reopen things? All kinds of questions. So,
Catherine, throw a laurel.
Do we? Is that what we do with laurels? We throw them.
I don't know.
Put them in the.
Laurels and darts, right?
We'll put them in your cherry-picked mushroom cloud of inboxes or
we
whatever
pair them with
happened
Hardy.
Earlier. I want to give a shout out to the hardworking lifestyle journalists out there who, frankly, have done some pretty good. Some pretty good stuff. Like I am in general consuming a fair bit of what I might have dismissively referred to as mommy blogging back in the day. These days, looking for help with my parenting and homeschooling challenges, and I think people have kind of risen to it, up to and including I think the New York Times this weekend had quite a good piece that basically did a full mea culpa on the vilifying of screen time, just like a 180 on that, which I appreciated. And just, you know, in general, I think the often disrespected or disregarded work that those journalists do to actually make people's lives better has been very apparent to me as I have been suddenly looking for ways to fix a bunch of things in my life that feel like they are not going very well in my household. So shout out to lifestyle journalists who are like trying to help us get through this.
So can I suggest you read Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner, Catherine, and that'll alleviate the last shreds of kind of actual human interaction you want to have with your kids.
Thank you, Nick, for that helpful tip. Shout out to Nick Gillespie, who's really given the resources we all need.
My strong belief is that anything that references Walden is terrible. Suderman, what do you have?
Just very quickly, it's my lifestyle journalism that I resort to when I need help is video game websites. And I read video game websites because they are so reliably, consistently focused on video games and not on anything else. And so they have, of course, been reporting that games are being delayed and game conferences are being pushed off. And like, I mean, the pandemic is affecting the world of video games as well. But also, new video games are still coming out. People are still playing video games. And what I have really appreciated about the world of video game coverage right now is how I can go to it and it feels almost normal. It feels like maybe people are just sitting in their basements on their couches playing Doom Eternal and trying to figure out how to get through this one really hard jump puzzle where on nightmare mode. Because, in fact, if you're playing video games, that's like there is a sort of a sense of normalcy, right? Like not much has changed about playing Doom Eternal in the last month or so relative to the rest of the world. The other piece of journalism that I would actually single out is just a really excellent bit of investigative work from Eric Boehm, our colleague. It's titled Why You Shouldn't Trust Anyone Who Claims 80% of America's Drugs Come from China. And this is a stat that has been going around in high-level publications and amongst experts who have testified in front of Congress. People, you know, saying, well, look, all of these drugs definitely come from China, and therefore we're going to have to completely rework our trade lines and our supply lines and, you know, nationalize the drug industry and all of this. And it all comes from, apparently, like Eric did the kind of, he read the footnotes and he kept reading the footnotes until he got back to the original statistic. And it all comes from a Government Accountability Office report a couple of years ago that doesn't in any way say the thing that people have been saying that it says. It is classic stat debunking. In, you know, it's in the mold of great old school Reason. I was really, really pleased with how the piece came out. Lucky to get to read it and edit it a little bit before it went live. And just truly excellent work by our colleague.
Has anybody in Minecraft gotten coronavirus yet? Like, is Tennis Steve still walking around okay? Or what's going on, Peter? Has the virus actually appeared in video games?
My suspicion is that if you drill down far enough into the ether, into the ore of Minecraft, you're going to find that's where you'll eventually find the vaccine. That's where we're going to get the treatment from, is we're going to model it in Minecraft. A large group of people who we don't know about, a consortium of Minecrafters are just going to build a virtual model of it, and then some big drug company is going to be like, hey, maybe that'll work, and they'll make it.
Like, you're sort of joking, but also that keeps happening.
I'm mostly joking.
But it, like, that
I'm mostly joking.
But that kind of thing actually does, like, remember there was that protein folding game that people were using?
Yep.
Like, it's a joke, but it's also not a joke at all.
I would tack on to the end of this conversation two observations. One is that you will see, I think there's a new report out today that in the New York Times that 28,000 journalists have lost their jobs. Terrible for those journalists. My heart's out to them. It's also terrible for the many, 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 many millions of other Americans who have lost their jobs as well. There are going to be calls. There already have been some by people who are inclined to go this way. This happened 10 years ago as well during the financial crisis, to have the government, federal government, bail out newspapers, the journalism industry in some way. That's a terrible, terrible, terrible idea. Please don't do that.
Please don't do that.
Just don't do that. It's don't get your government in my journalism. That is the general rule. It's one of the reasons why, in addition to everything else, America has more robust journalism than a lot of places where the government has more of a role. It seems paradoxical unless you think about it. That's one thing. The other thing that actually is more worthy of criticism, because it's something that we experience on a daily basis, whether at the Centers for Disease Control or various mayors and governors and presidents, is that the CDC in 2006 issued a pretty comprehensive, this is our guideline for pandemics. And in it, they underlined over and over and over again the necessity to be forthright with the public about relevant information and to not, like, pull their chains about things in order just to get to the desired response. Like, just be honest with stuff. That's how things work best, because if they get the sense that you're being dishonest in a way to try to engender certain results that you are seeking, then you lose credibility and they're not going to listen to you the next time. We have seen that in this crisis so many times. The CDC with masks, for crying out loud, individual mayors and governors and presidents saying things that are just wrong about the way that the disease is spread, constantly treating us like little sheeplets who need to be put in this direction or that direction. That's wrong. Listen to your own advice, which is tell us the truth, including about the stuff that you don't know, and stop lying, because lying is bad in general, but it's super bad during times of pandemic, and it also erodes your credibility and leads to a lot of bad other things. The end. Let's go to our end of podcast. What have you been consuming during the long, never-ending movie night of the soul that we've been having? Catherine, you've probably had some movie nights, unlike Suderman, who's just has, you know, Minecraft nights. What have you been consuming?
No movies. My children are watching a lot of movies, but those are the times when I am actually being productive. So I am not watching a lot of movies. I am reading, just started last night, a Peter Suderman recommendation of a 2014 novel called Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. And it is about a devastating flu pandemic that kills most of the world's population. And it's really good, and not it would be the opposite of escapism, I would say.
Why?
Fuck it. Because I'm already thinking about those things, so I might as well read about them too. I did my one woman Jane Austen reading festival. I made my way through most of the Jane Austen in the last couple of weeks, and it was time for me to re-engage a little. So this is how I am doing that. I'm sorry I've been so profane on this podcast. I know it hurts your heart, Matt.
I'm just protecting the brand. Nick, protect our brand further. What have you been consuming besides all of B.F. Skinner's oeuvre?
No, I live that, Matt. You don't get away from that. It marks you for life. You know, I've had, and I don't know if you guys have had this experience, it's been really hard to read, like fiction or even nonfiction, other than journalism. Like, I'll read stuff on screens, but I had been hoping to go through, you know, older novels or longer things. That hasn't been happening as much as I would have liked, but I've been rewatching The Americans, which ran from 2013 to 2018, and it's about Soviet sleeper spies in Washington during the 80s, and it kind of marks the arc from Reagan's election to kind of the beginning of glasnost and perestroika and the end of the Soviet Union. And it's fantastic. It has a lot of resonance right now because they go through things where the Soviet sleeper agents are securing bioweapons from Fort Detrick, you know, so there's kind of a pandemic overlay, as well as I was just watching an episode where the day after aired, I think that was in 1983 or 84, talking about that. But there's a lot of end-of-world scenarios there throughout the 80s, which is kind of a, you know, it's both comforting and also disturbing that we're constantly living on the edge of, you know, the end of the world and whatnot. So I've been watching that, and it's a remarkable show because it, you know, it reminds us that the end times are kind of always with us. At the same time, it provides a bit of escapism because it's about the Cold War and about the risk of nuclear annihilation, which has more or less passed. I mean, there's still, you know, more than enough nuclear weapons to blow up the planet and all of that, but it's just not the same kind of concern.
I would just point out that it's all shot in my neighborhood where I live. There are production offices around the corner.
And Gowanus.
The drops are all in like little, like my neighborhood park or the other park around the corner. Yeah. And the little bridges are all over the Gowanus Canal. So it's very, do you want to see? Want to see where Matt lives? Let's watch the Americans, and it's also a phenomenal show.
That's why I'm watching.
Yeah,
it,
Matt, I know.
You know, because we are in shelter in place, so I can't observe you and surveil you from the street like I normally do.
Yes,
you know, the one thing that I'll also say about it, which, and again, this almost seems quaint now, but it is. We interviewed Joe Weisberg and the showrunner about it. Weisberg had been a CIA agent in the 90s. And it is one of the most kind of sophisticated, nuanced engagement with what did the Cold War mean and how do individuals in two systems that are very different and have very different values, how do they kind of engage and what can you say about people under the Soviet system as individuals acting in what they thought were their best interests? It's really a phenomenal commentary on the Cold War and a much more balanced and important view that could only take place 20 years after the Cold War ended.
And I didn't quite make it to the end due to technical incapabilities, but the way that individuals are mangled by the necessity of the Cold War is a marvelous thing to reflect on. And they don't do it. That's not like they're not flashing it neon lights. That's what you're supposed to take away from it. But it is something. It is just right there in the background constantly and very fascinating. Suderman, what have you been consuming?
Like Nick, I've had a little bit of trouble reading over the past couple of weeks. It's just been sort of a slow process. But this weekend, I had a breakthrough. I went and read Normal People by Sally Rooney. And so I don't know if you guys remember, I recommended this. That's her a 2018 novel. It is her second novel. She's an Irish author, quite young. I think she's 29 now, probably wrote this when she was 26 or 27. May we all be so productive. I recommended her first novel, Conversations with Friends, a while ago on the podcast. And in fact, I was looking, I finished this book yesterday evening, and I texted Catherine about it because I wondered if she had read it since we had talked about Conversations with Friends previously. And I went back in our text messages, and I apparently read the first Sally Rooney novel and texted Catherine about it in January, which feels like 10 million years ago. Like, I have lived so many lives. The entire world is completely different at this point. It's just a sort of it really kind of brought home to me how time just feels like it has both stopped and sped up all at the same time in some really bizarre and strange way. But I would just strongly recommend Normal People to anyone who likes contemporary fiction at all. It is a literary page turner that is very psychologically smart about relationships and about class differences. Rooney is really a kind of surveyor of the world of not class conflict so much, but class separation and what it does to individuals and to relationships. Her fiction has often been kind of tagged as political, and even she will describe it sometimes that way. She's somewhere in the sort of communist socialist realm politically herself. But she is also, like all great writers, she's an individualist. She is someone who refuses to treat people as just sort of as members of a tribe, as kind of as group, as you know, sort of avatars of a group. Because what she wants to do is see inside people's heads. And what she finds there inside people's heads and minds and feelings is that people are weird and unique and messed up. And so even though, you know, I think she and I would have very, very strong differences of opinion about politics and about economic policy and about who makes a good leader, I just find her so fascinating as a writer because she's so smart and so perceptive about how individuals work in the context of themselves, in the context of each other, how their social circumstances change how they work, and how those social circumstances can come together in ways that clash and conflict and make life, on the one hand, much more interesting. For example, when you find somebody who you are just attracted to in a way that you kind of can't help, and also can make problems and trouble for you, and can create difficult situations. And so she is really, I think, my favorite young novelist at this point. And I would strongly recommend, like I said, anybody who likes fiction about contemporary relationships and sort of people who live in maybe not quite the world of April 2020, but any time pre-pandemic, the modern world. She is one of our foremost chroniclers of it.
So
I would be interested, Peter, in what you think about drawing connections between her kind of class analysis and that you see in movies like Parasite. I think there's something really interesting going on, mostly from the left, of a kind of an awareness of, as you were saying, individualism and class and the way that intersects in unpredictable ways. And I think it's something that libertarians should be more conscious of or engaging more, because it helps to explain, you know, the messiness of the world and also kind of the beauty of it and that kind of mixing.
There's a lot of both in Normal People.
I will use as my podcast topping examples. So we've been scraping perhaps near the bottom of the barrel of what can work on family movie night for a international couple and an 11-year-old and a 5-year-old. And so this movie was not aware of it. Maybe you guys are more sophisticated than I am. I mean, definitely, but that maybe you've been aware of it. But let's just say 13, 14 years ago, there was a Harvey Weinstein produced movie starring Mia Farrow, which already, like, this is starting to crack up.
Oh, my God.
It's half animated, so therefore it can appeal to various people. And among the main stars are Madonna, David Bowie, Snoop Dogg, Harvey Keitel, Jimmy Fallon, and Jason Bateman.
Oh God, I really hope this is one of the Bad Lieutenant movies.
It's called Arthur and the Invisibles, and it's directed by Luc Besson, just to throw it all into total chaos. You have to see it based on that description. I wish that it was better. The 11-year-old aggressively, I think, left after the 2/3 of the way. The 5-year-old pronounced it her favorite movie of all time. The French wife.
But that's simply because it's the most recent movie she's seen.
We tried to make her watch The Prisoner the other day. That didn't.
You guys need to get a grip.
Do they
what
see Madonna?
With your children?
The Prisoner? You know, Joan Crawford and whatever happened to Baby Jane? Like, they're just like, Madonna is 1,000 years old, right?
Yeah, and actually she plays someone who's about ready to get to her 1,000th birthday in the movie. I don't know if you realized what you said.
I did not know that. I know that she's about to turn 1,000 in this world.
1,000. Yes, that's yeah. But she looks
in a similar genre, simply because it is also partially animated and partially not, I suppose. My children told me that they prefer Mary Poppins Returns to the original Mary Poppins. So
I can say that.
I'm dead now.
Matt,
I'm sorry to report my own
the
death.
Original, like, 1960s Patrick McGowan, The Prisoner, like, from the BBC with, like, a giant beach ball Absolutely. That attacks you.
That's Emmanuel's yeah. favorite show, right?
That's okay, it's a yeah. great show. And my parents showed it to me when I was five or 6 years love. Old. I'm not sure that worked out well for anyone. Or maybe it... I mean, maybe it worked out great. I don't know. But like, I just learned from my parents' mistakes here.
That experiment
sounds
is
like
over.
It's too late.
The 5 year old is not dipping back. She doesn't like the rover. The rover is too scary for her, and I get it. It's kind of too scary for all of us. And anyway, Arthur and the Invisibles is it's not that great. It's sort of better on paper. David Bowie is phenomenal, and Snoop Dogg is fine, and some other people. But did I mention Robert De Niro is a main character? He's sure, why not?
Oh my god!
But it's all a bit too simplistic. The animation's kind of interesting to look at.
Matt, have you tried the Incredible Mr. Limpet with them?
No, not yet.
With starring Don Knotts. It's a set in World War II, and Don Knotts is he falls into the water and becomes a fish with sonar capabilities who can detect Nazi U-boats off the coast of New York.
Is he wearing glasses as a fish?
Yes.
Yeah, okay,
yeah, as a fish and in real life. It's a delight.
That will combine my current interests, which are to survive family movie night without bloodshed and to basically watch nothing except World War II related things. So that sounds perfect. All right, that's all the time that we have here. Thank you for checking in with us on the Monday Reason Roundtable. Stay tuned to all of our other podcasts, reason.com podcasts, especially the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, which is cranking out material in overtime. And thanks again. Hope you're all doing as well as can be under the circumstances and that we all get back to normal life sometime soon. Goodbye.